You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orhan Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello, Book Talk Today family, and welcome back to another episode of the Book Talk Today podcast. My name is Orhan. I am your host, and Happy New Year. This is the first podcast of 2022. I'm so happy to be bringing you this podcast and to be here for 2022. 2021 was a great year for the podcast, and I'm super excited for this year for the podcast. In today's episode, we are joined by Angus Fletcher. Angus is a professor of story science at Ohio State's Project Narrative, the world's leading academic think tank for the study of how stories work. In our conversation, we discussed his most recent book, Wonder Works: Literary Invention and the Science of Story. This book draws on cutting-edge research to demonstrate how our brain is a story interpreter and shows how it actually works. Angus has an interesting background as he is a neuroscientist, but he also has a fascination with literature that he studied as well. So he brings the two worlds together. And in our conversation, we touched upon many different areas, from how the education system teaches literature wrong to approaching reading the right way and using literature as mental medicine. It was a really enlightening conversation and one that I'm really looking to share with all of you. And I think it's a wonderful podcast to start 2022. Any podcast about literature is great, but another one to start the year is always great as well. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast. The podcast comes out every single week and we are really excited for 2022. We already have some amazing guests scheduled for the coming weeks. So please do subscribe to the podcast, regardless of where you listen to it, whether it's on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple. Please do subscribe and leave a rating as well. Without further ado, here is the conversation with Angus. Enjoy. Angus, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
I'm thrilled to be here.
This idea of understanding the brain and its connection to literature is something that has fascinated me for quite a long time. We've had Will Storr on the podcast to talk about storytelling, and we've had a professor of psychology from University of Dublin as well to talk about the link between the brain and literature as well. So I was really interested to have you on after reading the book to understand the relationship between the two, because like I said, I think it's fascinating. So I think before we get into some of the elements of the book, I'd love to hear about your background and how you came to write this book.
Yeah, so I'm basically a neuroscientist who sort of went rogue. I got my training at the University of Michigan in a physiology lab. We were basically studying how individual neurons talk with each other. And like everyone else on this planet, I'm just fascinated by the human brain. I mean, the human brain, as interesting as everything else is in our universe, the human brain is the most interesting thing I've ever encountered because it produces so many extraordinary, wonderful things. I mean, all the wonderful, unique people you meet in the world who have their own completely idiosyncratic and delightful personalities, the arts, the culture, the technology, all the stuff that comes out of the human brain. And then also, of course, all the horror, the violence, the stupidity, you know, the fact that we're on the verge of destroying our own planet. I mean, you know, it's just this infinite mystery and paradox. And I think I just wanted to understand how it worked. And like almost everyone else at the time, our lab thought that the human brain was basically a computer. And they thought that it basically like kind of took in data and then, you know, stored that data in its memory banks and then processed and crunched that data. And then it malfunctioned when it had emotions and all these kinds of things. And I was just sitting there and I just realized the human brain does not work like a computer at all. The computer brain, it does not take in a lot of data. It's very data light. If you've ever met a human, you know that. Humans are actually not interested in facts or data or figures at all, you know? Nor is emotion a malfunction in the human brain. I mean, some of the best things about humans are our empathy, our courage, our kindness, all these things. And so I just thought to myself, like, I want to understand all these other things about the brain that are not computer related. Even though there are parts of the brain that can be understood as a computer, there are all these other parts that aren't, and where to understand those parts. And I just thought, well, literature is a great starting place because literature is filled with creativity, which is one of the kind of unique non-logical parts of the human brain. And it's also just filled with emotion, passion, all these interesting things. And so I went off and I got my doctorate at Yale studying Shakespeare. And that was the beginning of a long, long journey, which culminated in the book you have, which basically has put neuroscience and literature together.
What were some of the key findings then during your time studying literature, and how did you find the link, or what were some of the key themes and links between the two?
One of the biggest things I would say is that the way we're being taught to understand literature in school now is completely unhelpful and almost entirely wrong. So the way we think about literature and books and all these things in school is, first of all, we think about it largely as a kind of escapist thing. You'll hear that a lot. Oh, it's this place where you just go to have fun and dream, and it's totally detached from reality, and it's about science fiction, fantasy, all this kind of stuff. That's completely inaccurate. Literature evolved during incredibly difficult times in human history when we just didn't have the resources to hang out and just have fun all the time. And so it has these incredibly powerful, useful psychological functions, which are not just kind of necessary for us as individuals, but for us as societies. So the first thing that, you know, that the usefulness of literature was kind of the first big thing. The second thing is we're just taught to read literature all wrong. We're basically taught to read literature the way the monks in the Middle Ages read the Bible, which is to say we're taught to interpret it for themes and representations. And the technical term for this is semiotics. It's the application of logic to language. And it's basically all we do. It's kind of mainstreamed by this guy, I.A. Richards, at Cambridge in the 1920s and 1930s. It becomes the basis of all the way that we study literature now. And that's not how literature works at all. Anyone who's been in a class knows that when you sit up and read a book on your own, you're not analyzing it for its themes and what it means. You're plugging into the characters, you're plugging into the world and the story, you're feeling suspense, you're feeling empathy, you're feeling all these kinds of emotional things. And perhaps most importantly, your imagination is just popping. It's not a logic exercise in which you're analyzing the words. In fact, a lot of times when you're reading, you're not even conscious of the words at all. You're seeing places and people and events in your head. So I was just like, look, whatever we're doing in school, even if it is worthwhile in some way, it's not capturing most of what's actually special about literature. And so what my work does is basically go back to how our brains actually process literature, which is not really related at all to language, for technical reasons we can get into at all. Language and interpretation has almost nothing to do with it. Words has very little to do with literature. And also to kind of access the incredible power that literature has to make our lives better. To give us more courage, to give us more love, to heal us from trauma, to help us get over loneliness, to make us better scientists, to help us think in these powerful, creative, imaginative ways. And even as I talk about in later chapters of the book, to do apparently impossible things, like actually make our dreams come true, because literature can stimulate this power of the brain known as counterfactual thinking, in which we reimagine the world and literally make the future as we see it, as opposed to what it was going to be otherwise. So that's the kind of big stuff, I guess.
Yeah, it's the big themes of the book, definitely. And towards the end, you definitely talk about the idea of manifestation and the idea of hope and all that type of stuff. One of the things at the beginning of the book that you mentioned is the idea of the narrator, which I think is a very interesting concept in literature, because when you're getting told a story, it's almost as if someone's telling it to you. But when you have a narrator, it's like an internal dialogue. So when you're reading a book, like you said, you're not analyzing the words for the words itself. You're placing yourself within the story. And that's what I think sometimes when I studied English literature at school, I didn't study at university, but when I studied at school, I was like, why are we analyzing like the key, really technical concepts of either word placement or the use of language and these types of stuff? Why aren't we analyzing the behavior, like what it would be like to be in that position as a human emotive element? So I definitely agree with you.
I mean, that's exactly right. And that's the key. And that intuition that you had back then is the intuition that I wish more teachers of literature had. It's essentially the shift from this weird objective way that we read literature now, where we analyze all these words, into entering the voice and the psychology of the person who's telling us the story. Because that's actually how our brains grow. Our brains grow by being able to kind of enter into other minds and imagine ourselves as other people. And this is something that your brain kind of does a little bit when it's wandering around the world, is it looks at other people and kind of imagines, why did they do that? But literature gives you direct access. So literature just allows you to leap into the mind of Jane Austen or Homer or Maya Angelou or all these other kind of creatives and just go, 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 go. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to do in the book is there's this theory or this kind of tendency among academics to act as if you stop talking about the words and all of a sudden it becomes very fuzzy and nonspecific. And then we're talking about emotions and emotions are all these, we're talking about perspectives or imagination. It's not precise. And this book is aggressively precise. I mean, I go down and I talk very precisely in terms of the specific formal elements that were invented, how they plug into very specific parts of your brain. And the goal there is to show that you can be highly technical, highly responsible, while talking about all these apparently fuzzy, nebulous things like feelings and creativity. And, you know, the goal there is for everyone who was ever in a literature class like you were when you were younger to say, you can do this. And you can do it in a way that's precise with a rigorous method that you can learn over time and get better at so that you actually get better at entering other people's minds.
Do you think part of the problem is at school, at the school level, we tend to separate the sciences with the literature? We almost think they're two different elements, whereas in fact, like in your book, you very much find the distinction between them and how they're very, very interlinked. Do you think at school we're very much like you're either into science or you're either into literature? There's no cohesion between the two.
I mean, that is a huge problem. There's no question about it. And science would benefit from spending more time with literature, and literary people would benefit from spending more time with scientists. I mean, you know, science, if you spend too much time in the humanities, you would sometimes be led to think that scientists are not imaginative or creative or any of these things. And of course, scientists are some of the most creative, imaginative people in the entire universe. If you spend too much time with the scientists, you would think, oh, literature is just a waste of time. I was actually told by a number of scientists when I left my lab that I was wasting my life by going to study literature. Literature is perhaps the most important thing that humans have ever invented, because it allows us to get more performance out of the human brain, allows us to troubleshoot grief and anxiety and anger and all these things, you know, and allows us to become our better selves. And if you could just make humans 5% better, I mean, think about the effects of that. And literature has that power, has that potential. So I think scientists would benefit a lot from hanging out with more humanists too.
So how does our brain actually compute storytelling? Like, what are some of the key elements to sort of take those words on the page and represent them within our own minds? How does that actually happen from a neuroscience point of view?
Okay, so first of all, I'm just going to contradict everything you said. I know that's what we've all been taught. We've been taught that basically we input the words and then we develop these representations in our head. That's what we would do if we were computers, because that's how computers work. Computers use something called symbolic logic. And so they input data points, symbols, and then they use those to build these kinds of representational grids. The human brain does not operate like that at all, except with, you know, I mean, the visual cortex and some other areas of the brain are representational, but the main kind of core processing parts of the brain do not operate like that. What's important about the way that the human brain processes literature is that the human brain is an action machine. We think in actions. Most of what goes on in our head is, I'm going to do this, or that was done, or how did that happen? So we think in terms of causes and effects, not in terms of representations. And when you think in terms of causes and effects, what you're thinking in terms of is actors and actions, which is another way of saying characters and plots. So when your brain picks up a book, the first thing it starts to do is say, who is in this book? What are they doing? And that's why, of course, you know, the first thing that happens when you pick up a book is you immediately notice either the characters or the narrator. And then you're like, what's going on here? What's happening? So the first thing to just realize is that the human brain is a narrative processor, it's a story processor. Literature is stories. Stories can exist without words. Words are just memorial prompts for helping us kind of get into that. And in fact, stories cannot be reduced to words for complicated reasons we can get into or not, which is why computers cannot actually read books for complicated reasons we can get into or not on this podcast. But the main thing is, if you want to read literature and get the most out of it, forget about the words and focus on characters, focus on worlds, focus on stories, focus on voices. and all those kinds of things which are natural, intuitive to your brain. And then don't try and find what's universal about them. This is another kind of computer habit that we get into in English literature classes. Mm-hmm. We're always looking for these universal themes. And the number of times someone has told me that, oh, Shakespeare has these universal themes in it. And that's total nonsense. Human brains are not interested in universal themes, whether or not they may or may not be something you can extract from Shakespeare. Humans are interested in the specific, the unique, the original. You know, you're not best friends with your best friend because they're a universal friend. You're best friends with your best friend because of something that's unique about your best friend, the way their mind works, something that's special about them. And it's the same thing with characters that we like in stories. We like what's unique about them, and we like stories because of what's unique about them. And all these kinds of formulaic approaches to stories that tell us, oh, there are these universal plots or this kind of stuff, that is incredibly boring to humans. Human brains are not interested in that because human brains evolved biologically to be seekers, to be curious, because we're always part of these evolving environments, and we too are always trying to find what's the next thing to help me survive. So the main takeaway is focus on story stuff and focus on what's unique and special, not what's generic and thematic.
So in contemporary storytelling, there's this idea that sort of the Joseph Campbell model is a model for representing story. So are you basically saying that that idea of the hero's journey and those universal truths of storytelling isn't wholly accurate? Or are you saying it fits a purpose for a certain time?
Yeah, Joseph Campbell is total bunk. First of all.
I thought you'd say that.
Joseph Campbell's whole theory of the hero's journey, let's talk about that first, and then let's talk about why his deeper method beyond his specific ideas is also not helpful.
Sure.
So his specific idea is derived of this mashup of these, this idea from George Frazer, who is this totally discredited 19th century anthropologist, this British anthropologist, who basically had this idea that all cultures were telling the same story as the British Empire. So he basically sent out these letters from his Scottish home, you know, across to the various quadrants of the British Empire, trying to confirm his previous hypothesis that basically all stories were the same stories you could find in the Bible and Shakespeare. And this is complete nonsense. Other cultures tell different stories. You know, there's a huge variety of global literature. It's not the same story recycled over and over and over again. But nevertheless, Frazer came up with this idea that all cultures are telling the same story of a hero who sacrifices himself to rebirth everyone else. So that's part one of the Joseph Campbell pseudoscience. Part two is Freud, who is not only a completely debunked psychologist, but is one of the most detrimental pseudo-academics in history. I mean, the number of lives who have been damaged by Freud, the number of young people who have gone into a clinician's office in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and had their minds torn apart by his totally and utterly bunk theories. So then we have this idea from Freud that our dreams can be interpreted. So that's part two of the Joseph Campbell pseudoscience. And then part three is Carl Jung, who's a very nice person, unlike Freud, who's not a kind of like malevolent presence. But, you know, had this totally bogus idea of the collective unconscious, that somehow all humans were participating in this universal archetypal mind, populated with these archetypal characters and story elements. So anyway, you mash those together and you get the hero's journey, which is this idea that every story is basically about a hero who journeys, into our collective unconscious to recover the truth and then bring it back for us all to see. I mean, that's basically. So if you believe in British imperialism circa the end of the 19th century, if you believe in Freud, and if you believe like Carl Jung that, you know, you and I have the same mind as an alien somewhere out there, 100 billion light years away, and there's no such thing as individual minds or creativity or uniqueness or distinct cultures or any of these kinds of things, then yes, absolutely, the hero's journey is the story for you. If you believe in science and biology, then no, it's basically up there with astrology. The deeper problem with Joseph Campbell's whole approach, though, is this idea that universal stories exist or would be a good thing. Story evolved in the human mind as a way of creating plots and plans in response to environmental challenges and opportunities. So in other words, anytime one of our ancestors encountered something they hadn't seen before, they had to come up with a new sequence of actions with how to deal with that. Maybe it was a good thing that they wanted to kind of get more of in their life. You know, maybe it was something challenging that they wanted to figure out how to overcome. And in our own lives, it's the same. Our lives are constantly changing. The people who come into our lives, they're all different. We have to figure out new ways to interact with the people around us by listening carefully to them and what makes them distinct. We have to see the kinds of opportunities that are opening up in our global landscape. We have to respect other cultures by listening to them and seeing what's distinct about them. And this means that our mind has to constantly keep coming up with new actions, new plots, new plans, new narratives. That's where story comes from. It's about adapting and changing to our environment, making ourselves new, branching and growing. And so, like everything biological, there's not one ideal story. If you look out in a forest, is there one ideal tree? You know, I mean, this whole idea of the universal is this fever dream, which we get from the Enlightenment and from Plato. And essentially, it's a kind of patriarchal imperialism, which is, you know, I'm going to find the one truth and then impose it on everyone else. And it's just anti-life and anti-biological. So if you want my opinion, which you've already had in a screed rant, the hero's journey is itself total bunk, but any attempt to find universal stories is not healthy and not good. And we should be spending our time opening up our minds, embracing different kinds of stories, different ways of telling stories, and encouraging young people to be creative, not to be formulaic. I mean, does our society need more formula? Mm. Do we need less imagination? Is that really, do we look out at the world and say, oh, there's too much imagination in this world? There's too many good ideas, actually. We need to have more formula and we need to have more people marching in lockstep. That's really what the world needs. So it's totally wrong biologically and I think also wrong ethically.
I love the distinction that you said there about the formulaic aspect because it does reduce story to some sort of boxed. You have to stay in a box of storytelling. If you go outside of the box of storytelling, you're not wanted. All your stories are complete garbage. So I do like that distinction that you made. Also to imperialism, I like that as well because I've never thought about it that way. It's the patriarchal imperialist view of storytelling.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I say this and I'm not here to like, you know, bash the British Empire and all these things, you know. I mean, if the British Empire had worked, great, you know. I mean, you know, but the fact is what it did is it went around and destroyed. I mean, it was just an incredibly destructive presence, you know. I mean, there were a lot of well-intentioned people behind it, but it was totally wrong. And I think we have to sort of get ourselves out of the idea that there's one right way of doing things, which is a kind of pervasive myth in the modern world, that somehow if everyone acted like me, the world would be a better place. You know, everyone else is wrong. There's a truth which I have access to. Everyone has to listen to me and act like me. That's not correct biologically. Wow. Biologically, diversity is deeply important. It's the essence of life. We have to cherish and respect other people, other cultures, other species that are different from us. And, you know, one of the root functions of story is to open our minds up to different ways of thinking, experiencing, living. And the more we get ourselves into this idea that there's a right and a wrong way to tell story, that in itself, by the way, is the fastest way to kill creativity, is to tell someone that there's a right and a wrong way to do it. One of the things that we know from our schools is that our schools are radically diminishing the creativity of our kids. Children go to school around the age of 8 or 9, they start losing creativity. Why is that? They're part of a school system that keeps telling them there's a right and a wrong. They go home, they turn on the TV. The TV is always telling them there's a right way or a wrong way. There's so much binary thinking and partisanship now in the modern world. Everyone is telling you it's got to be this thing or the other thing. And, you know, the opportunity of art, of creativity, of literature, and of science is to break out of that nonsense and say there's lots of right ways of doing things. There's lots of wonderful things. There's a huge amount of possibility out there in life and in each human brain. And, you know, we should kind of unstick ourselves from this idea of right and wrong and open ourselves more to growth, possibility, opportunity, joy, listening, all these kinds of things that you just get naturally from stories.
And part of those things that I think you're talking about are the deeply human elements to it. And with the rise in technology, with artificial intelligence, I remember hearing a story a couple of weeks ago about how there's artificial intelligence that they're trying to create that are going to be able just to replicate stories. It's going to be analyzing all the stories in the past, and then it'll be able to create stories, as many stories as possible. So it'll make human creation of stories redundant because you'll just have AI creating stories. how do you believe that the growth in technology and development in AI is going to affect storytelling and how we consume it?
So I work a lot in AI, and the idea that AI is going to tell stories is complete nonsense. It's total nonsense. I actually published a proof of this last year, and with the second part that's coming out in a month or so. If you want, I can make it available to the listeners of this podcast. The reason that AI can't and will never tell stories is because AI is logical. And as we sort of started by talking, the human brain is not a computer, and story does not come from the computer parts of the human brain. Story and logic are two different, totally distinct forms of intelligence. They are mechanically different. They require different machinery. The human neuron operates differently than a transistor in a computer. And once you start to understand that, you realize that there are things that transistors simply cannot do. And one of them is tell stories. The simple proof of this fact is that natural language processors, which are these AI machines, which are supposedly going to, you know, read stories and tell stories, cannot handle action verbs. Because logic, formal symbolic logic, which is what they use, cannot handle action verbs. It can only handle nouns, adjectives, and linking verbs. And so what AI has to do is it has to break action verbs into linking verbs. Simple example, John walks. A computer has to break that into John is walking. Well, it sounds like the same thing, but it's actually not, because it means a computer has no idea what the action of walking is. It can only think of walking as a state. And so when computers try and write stories, they can only write stories that consists of nouns, adjectives, and linking verbs, which is actually not a story. It's a series of logical propositions. And that's why all of these computer programs, GPT-3, all the rest of them, completely fail. You know, I've done a lot of technical work with things like Judea Pearl's Do Calculus and other kinds of, supposed programs that can allow for narrative. None of them will ever. They will never, ever, ever, ever be a computer that creates a story. Now, that does not mean that in the future we couldn't invent a different kind of machine that could create story. You know, maybe that will happen. I don't know. I can't say that that's not going to happen. But I can assure you that in our lifetimes and in our children's lifetimes, there's never going to be an AI that creates story. And the deeper problem here is that we have this obsession in our culture with investing in AI as opposed to investing in humans. There's this culture of thinking that somehow AI is smarter than people. AI is incredibly stupid. I would recommend anyone out there to go and read Eric Larson's book, The Myth of Artificial Intelligence. It came out on Harvard University Press earlier this year. Eric and I are actually working together on a fairly big DARPA project right now. We're doing a lot of work with US Special Operations, various Silicon Valley companies. So this is not kind of like make-believe. What Eric and I both believe is that computers can be very, very powerful at solving a small set of problems, which are logic problems. But the human brain can solve lots and lots of non-logical problems. And the simple way to think about this is that to solve a logic problem, you need enough data. And it needs to be good data. And if you don't have enough good data, AI immediately breaks. It just shatters and does weird things. The human brain can solve problems with almost no information. Think about all the things you've done in your life with almost no information. How have you been able to do that? Because our brains think differently, you know? And we have an experimental psychology, which uses actions to try things, and then takes in the feedback and so on and so forth. Things that computers just cannot do cognitively. So the main takeaway, again, and I apologize for ranting, is we should be spending way, way less money in AI and way, way more money in humans and kids and children and schools and books and literature and these kinds of things, which help grow human brains, help make those brains happier, increase their well-being, make them, you know, less brittle, more imaginative, more creative. That's the path to a better future, not some kind of strange dystopian Elon Musk singularity.
How do stories affect the brain then and help well-being, help anxiety? You touched upon it in the book as well. Specifically, I know you talked about, which was a bit that I wanted to bring up, about the neuroscience in Virginia Woolf style and the idea that, you know, they can help with anxiety, and there's sort of this cognitive distancing, neuroscience distancing as well, to help us deal with our problems in our actual lives. So can you just talk about how literature does that and how it affects the brain in that way?
Yeah, so the first thing I just want to make clear is that, like any technology, literature is problem specific. So the same book that helps you with anxiety is not going to help you with loneliness, because those are different psychological processes. Sure. And so the first thing you want to do is not just kind of take this approach of just going to the library and then reading a bunch of literature and thinking that's going to help you. I mean, that would be the equivalent of just walking into a pharmacy, just grabbing a bunch of pill bottles and then eating them all and being like, I'm cured. You want to be thoughtful in your reading, and you want to say, okay, you know, what are the problems that I'm struggling with most? Am I struggling with certain feelings of trauma? If I'm suffering from certain kinds of feeling of trauma, well, you should know that some of the earliest literature in history, Greek tragedy, was developed to help produce feelings of catharsis. And it's being used today by veterans in studies that I've been fortunate to participate in to continue help with trauma. But there's actually two types of trauma, as authors have discovered. And different books help with different kinds of trauma. So the first thing is to be clear about what you want to get from literature and be specific. Then you can start to identify the specific works of literature that help you cope with those feelings of trauma or grief or loneliness or these other things. In the case of Virginia Woolf, this idea of cognitive distancing, she in Mrs. Dalloway invents this brilliant, beautiful new form of stream of consciousness style, in which we are constantly moving in between different characters' minds, but at a remove, which allows us to observe the kind of turmoil that they're experiencing while ourselves feeling just lightly distanced from it. So we can sense that turmoil even as the sort of beauty and the poetry of the writing gives us this feeling of distance and detachment. And if you read Mrs. Dalloway, and you have a kind of restless, agitated mind, you will feel just by reading it that it eases that feeling in your mind. Now, that's not to say that if you have a different kind of thing, if you feel lonely and you meet Mrs. Dalloway, you'll feel better. But it is to say, if you have that specific feeling at that specific time, that novel will help you. And that's the point of the book, is to basically say there's just all this wonderful therapeutic stuff out there in literature. You just have to know how to connect your specific need with the technology that an author has created.
I think it's the approach of how people sell fiction books, because, you know, I run a page where I speak a lot about nonfiction books, and people like to think like nonfiction books is there like medicine for a problem, but fiction books are just there, like you said earlier in this conversation, for escapism or just for people who want to go out to a faraway world and live with fairies or whatever it might be. So do you actually think it's has how publishers and authors talk about their books and approach the use of them? Like you said, you are doing studies for veterans about how they can use stories thousands of years old in order to help with trauma and what they're going through. So do you think part of it is how these stories are sold to people?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think that contributes. But I would just say, to be fair to the public in publishing industry, I mean, this research in this book is completely new. It's not like this is something that the publishing industry has known about and is actively ignoring. I mean, this book is the first time that a lot of this has really been brought to light. And part of what I hope will happen in the future is publishers, authors, and readers will get together in groups and say, you know, this is the kind of psychological benefit that I took from this work. Did you take the psychological benefit from this work? Let's start thinking about literature more seriously. Because you're right, I mean, a lot of nonfiction falls into, I guess, what is often now referred to as kind of self-help, you know, where the idea is we're going to give you some rules that make your life better and you're going to do these things. And the reality is the reason that people keep buying so many self-help books is because none of them really work. And so people keep trying to get more books. And the reason that self-help books don't really work is not a problem with the books themselves. I mean, most of the advice that most of the books giving is probably pretty okay. It's just that it doesn't connect with your brain in a way that makes it sustainable.
Yes.
Whereas if you actually read a novel that immerses you in the story, that story then becomes part of your story. It becomes part of your intuitive lived experience, and it changes your relationship to life. And so all those nonfiction books are good at kind of identifying some of these things that you should be doing, but it's really literature that actually helps plug in on that more fundamental level. But you know, to do that, you have to join with the literary work. You kind of have to let it in, and you have to work with it in that dynamic way. You can't just kind of try and analyze it. And, you know, you can't just keep reading the same kinds of books over and over again. I think one of the things that happens with a lot of readers is they're just like, I like reading romance books. And so I'm just gonna read a ton of romance books, or I like reading sci-fi, so I'm gonna read a ton of these, you know. And if you really want to help your brain grow, you have to get out of your own reading comfort zone and keep stretching into these other areas. And so again, part of what I try to do in the book is say, look, here's some key things you can know about these other ways of reading and kind of help expand. But the main thing is with everything in life is diversity, stretching, going beyond the one into the many. And, you know, publishers, because of the short attention span, I think, of the world nowadays, understandably just try and focus and target and be really specific and say, you know, fiction is for beach reading, you know, and nonfiction is for like self-help or, you know, whatever. But the reality is that we actually need to kind of back out of this short attention span world. It's not healthy for any of us, and start to dwell more in different kinds of books.
What's your approach to reading? Like, how do you personally, with all this knowledge of how our brains work and obviously your love of story, having studied it and obviously being a proficient reader as well, what's your personal approach to your own reading? I think that'd be valuable for the people listening.
So the first thing I would say is I never trust myself to choose my own books. Because if I were to choose my own books, I would just choose books that remind me of books that I've already read, you know? And this, incidentally, is, of course, what computers do, is computers are always recommending, you know, you get one of these search algorithms that just keeps recommending stuff to you that's like the stuff you've already read, because computers have no imagination. Like the Amazon shop. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, or Netflix binge watching or whatever, you know. If you want to grow yourself, you have to have different friends. And you have to have those different friends recommend you different books. I mean, that's really the key. And you have to have the courage and the drive to really get into those different books and embrace those different books. So, you know, when I teach, at a very high level, you know, I mean, I teach PhD students, MFA students, and I never assign any books in any of my classes. I always have my students bring in their favorite books or books that they think we should all read. And so every class is me basically exploring and expanding my brain by reading books that other people think are important for me to read. And I would say if you're a teacher, I would do the same thing for every teacher. Don't tell your students what to read. Ask them what you should read. You know, and the same thing obviously goes with anyone in your life, you know, asking them what to read, sharing your favorite books. I mean, that's a huge source of community. And that kind of basic idea that literature is fundamentally about listening to something that is different from ourselves, and that it's an opportunity for you to grow your mind outside of yourself, that to me, I think, is the kind of core operating principle of anyone who really, really loves books.
I think that is a very interesting point that you brought up about actually sharing books. I think everyone's looking for an actual book to solve a problem with their life, whether it's like making more money or achieving a certain type of job or a certain type of skill. And I think part of the reason is we don't look to fiction books or stories to solve that problem. And I don't know whether it's the way, as we've said before, about whether it's marketed, or I don't know it's whether it's about this knowledge that you're bringing in this book, but there seems to be a divide between those two that, like you said, hopefully will come in time.
Yeah. And I also think that we need to rearrange our thinking about how we need to fix ourselves and even if we need to fix ourselves. So there's just a lot of dissatisfaction that I encounter in people nowadays where they say, oh, I just wish I was, you know, making more money, or I wish I was this, or I wish I was this other thing, you know. And, you know, the reality of life is that you grow more by investing in behaviors as opposed to outcomes. So if you're just constantly focused on making more money, or, you know, figuring out how to market your Twitter account, or this kind of thing, That's both a very hard road to go and also deeply emotionally unsatisfying most of the time. If you instead say, I want to focus on making myself a more curious person or a kinder person or a braver person, you know, if I want to kind of focus on these things, then what will happen is you will feel immediate growth. Your days will become happier because you can see that growth happening. And then weird, unexpected, magical things that you never predicted will start happening in your life because you're just a braver, kinder person. And so braver, kinder things will start happening around you as opposed to you just making this more money, which you didn't actually really want anyway. You only thought you wanted it because you were constantly being bombarded with all these social media posts and kind of influencers telling you that somehow more money is the key to happiness or something. And I can certainly say that in my own life, I've had a completely bizarre life that I never could have imagined. And almost all the time when I tried to go get something and really was like, oh, you have to go get this thing, I never got it. But then other times when I just kind of focused on sort of, you know, hey, you know, maybe I could be a little bit more brave or maybe I could listen a little bit better, suddenly doors would open that I had never seen before and then I would walk through them and my life would be transformed. So I also think that it would be helpful if we just kind of shifted our psychology because literature gives you that opportunity to immediately get braver or immediately be kinder or immediately be more curious or immediately be more creative. And if we could start kind of valuing that kind of daily growth more, I think we'd all just be a lot happier.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the intrinsic versus the external. I think at the moment, you know, I'm on social media, I create social media posts and obviously want to try and get the message out there for myself and for the brand. But I think it's also important to understand that why are you learning? Why are you being curious? Why are you developing yourself? Is it to show other people that you're doing that? Or is it for yourself as an individual and for individual growth? Like for me, the idea of being curious is like central foundation for me as an individual, because if I'm not curious, if I'm not feeling like I'm curious in the morning, I'm like, why am I even getting up? Like, what's the point if I'm not looking to learn, grow, develop, understand myself and understand others? Where does curiosity come into it? Because a couple of weeks ago, I made a video on my YouTube about like 3 habits to be more curious. And I think it's a really underutilized skill, because I think it's the foundation for learning. I think it's the foundation for doing anything new and exciting and amazing. So where does curiosity come from a neuroscience point of view? I'd love to know your thoughts about what role curiosity plays in your life.
So curiosity is just about the most important thing, I have to say, particularly now in our modern world. So just to kind of talk just a little bit about the neuroscience, and I do talk about this a chapter in the book, and I talk about kind of how curiosity works in the brain and kind of how you can kind of become more curious by reading various books. But to kind of step outside that for a moment, the important thing to understand from a neuroscience perspective about curiosity is that it evolved to help us make the future. It's that kind of future thing, that kind of growing into what we're not now, that allows us to survive in a natural world, but also in our current world to be happy, because it's part of our nature. Because we, you know, in our past could only survive by being curious. Our brain is always seeking that growth, that newness, that self-change. So the difficulty for our brain is that when our brain evolved, the future was always slightly less important than the present. So you couldn't be too curious, because if you live too much in the future, you would get eaten in the present. And so curiosity evolved as what you could call a weak emotion in the brain, as compared to the stronger emotions of hope and fear. Because fear is kind of keeping you alive in the present by steering you away from bad stuff, and hope is keeping you alive in the present by dragging you towards good stuff. So curiosity is always a little bit weaker than hope and fear. And that's why you'll notice that most people in the world will be dominated by hope or fear. They'll either be kind of chasing their dreams or running away from their anxieties, as opposed to curiosity, which is this third way, which is ultimately a more fruitful way in the long term. And in our modern society, it's much more possible than it was in the ancient world, because none of us are in immediate danger anymore. You know, we can afford to be much more curious. And so the question is, well, how do you access that curiosity? And a big part of it comes from learning to exit your own hopes and fears. Most of us, more than 95% of what we think is dominated by hope and fear. So when you get up in the morning, 95% of the things that you think are possible that day will either be a hope or a fear. It's something you want to happen or are afraid will happen. And the reality is less than 1% of your hopes and fears ever come true. So that's a complete waste of your time to be spending 95% of your time thinking about things that are less than 1% likely to happen. So, you know, the first thing you want to do is you want to learn how to exit your hopes and your fears. And literature is a great way of doing that because literature helps you leave your life to be somebody else. The moment you start reading another person's life in a book, you leave behind your own hopes and fears. And so it just immediately opens curiosity without you having to do any other work at all. Reading a memoir, reading a novel, watching a movie. And that's why you'll just notice when you're in these activities, you suddenly become much, much, much more curious and interested. You want to learn about this other world and these other people because your own hopes and fears are just completely removed from the equation. And then the moment you put the literature aside, it's like, oh, how are we going to make the money to survive? Oh, you know, I'm so afraid that, like, you know, I'm not going to get enough likes on this account, on this post or whatever. You know, all these kinds of things, which is starts to, like, narrow your thinking. So just the simplest thing you can do to grow your curiosity is read literature. And curiosity is the number one thing you can do to improve your long-term happiness and growth. If you want to die happy, curiosity, more than hope and more than fear, is what you should invest in, because it is more likely to open actual doors that will actually change your life than your hopes or your fears ever will.
That's a very interesting way to put it. There's a third way. Hope and fear, put it aside. Put curiosity front and center. I definitely think that people don't prioritize curiosity as much as they should. I think we prioritize, like we said, making money, you know, getting popular, you know, these things that are obviously are important because obviously, you know, people need to live. But I think the long-term aspect of curiosity has been very beneficial for me personally. And I'm assuming for you as well, given what you do and your background as well. And the importance that asking questions has on uncovering worlds. And that's why I think literature is very interesting as well, because it uncovers a barrier. And that barrier is often can only go down if you start asking questions and are curious about what's on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And I think especially nowadays when we have created these kinds of siloed existences, where, I mean, more than any other time in history, we're constantly looking at ourselves. We're like Googling ourselves. We're looking at our own social media accounts. We're doing all this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, there's this endless kind of, you know, staring at ourselves all the time in the modern world. And first of all, it's just not healthy in the short term. I mean, it's just not good for your psychology and your happiness. But in terms of your long-term growth, it's also very bad, because the way to grow and be more successful and make more money and do all the things that you would actually want to do come from opening yourself up and having adventures and meeting different people and these kinds of things. And literature is a lovely, low-impact way of traveling around the world, traveling through time, traveling through space, traveling into other minds, doing all these kinds of things fast and effectively and in good hands. Because, you know, if an author has gotten published nowadays, you can trust that they're a pretty competent author. It's very hard to get a book published nowadays. So you can trust that you're going to go on a mostly safe journey with that author. And so, you know, it's just a great way really to invest in yourself. And you'll just see if you can every couple of weeks pick up a book that's a little bit different from a book that you would have read otherwise. So not just pick up any book. But pick up a book that's a little bit different. If you don't normally read memoirs, try reading a memoir. Or, you know, if you don't normally read romance, read a romance. If you're always reading romance, you know, go ahead and read some military fiction. You know, just read something that's different, but that's good, you know. And then just see how it starts to turn over new parts of your head without you even having to work at it. Because the whole point of both literature and curiosity is they're fun. They're fun. It's a joy. It's really joyful. And then the more you do that, the more you'll get into this joy space, which is just self-perpetuating. Learning is fun. Growth is fun. And, you know, hope and fear is just not that fun because it's a lot of waiting for stuff that doesn't exist and worrying about stuff that isn't true. Whereas curiosity is this lovely kind of space of mind expansion. And it's just there waiting for all of us all the time, as long as we can, like, stop, you know, Googling ourselves and checking our likes.
I think it's also the fact it goes back to that point of, like, getting out of our own way, isn't it? It's we know what we need to do, but we're almost programmed, or we see maybe what other people are doing or what we're expected to do and just follow that instead of actually going where we actually want to go.
I mean, that's so true. And, you know, this is both the good and the bad thing about the human brain is our brain is a very social organism. And it's good that we're a social organism. I mean, it's good that we spend so much time thinking about other people and, you know, thinking about how our behavior influences them and impacts them. I mean, that's just how our brain is. But it very rapidly turns unhealthy when we're worried about pleasing other people or measuring ourselves up against other people. That's really the last thing you ever want to do in your life. Don't compare yourself to other people. It would never make you happy. You will always feel like a failure and a disappointment. There's always someone out there that will have accomplished more than you in some area or another, you know? And so, you know, it's just a classic psychological truth, but a good one, that you want to compare yourself to yourself. Compare yourself to where you were yesterday. And as far as this kind of social part of our brain, you know, this part in terms of thinking about other people and thinking about the world, these kinds of things, instead kind of transition that around into gratitude, gratitude for other people's success, because that success makes us all stronger, you know, empathy and compassion, as opposed to smugness and judging when people make a mistake, you know, because that empathy and compassion is what you're going to want when you make a mistake. So it just comes from a kind of shift in how we kind of map these emotions over these different spaces. And that does allow us to get more of our own self. And, you know, that's really, at the end of the day, all we can do is be more ourselves, is be our best selves, and kind of look back at the end of our lives and be like, I lived the best life that I could live. I lived a brave life and a caring life. I took risks, you know, I took chances, I helped others, and I was myself. And if we can say that at the end of our life, I know people who have lived those lives, you'll be content, you'll be happy, you'll be yourself.
When's your self-help book coming out, Angus?
Well, so that's funny. I have occasionally been accused by American academics of having already written a self-help book in WonderWorks, because there is so much in it, which is basically about, you know, yeah, no, this is, well, I mean, you should know, I mean, this book has proved, you know, very popular among doctors and social workers and scientists and has not been that popular among traditional literary critics, who have in fact been terrified by a lot of what it has said. And so some of them have accused me of writing a self-help book. I have written a bunch of practical guides for other places. You know, I mean, I've just written a guide for the US military on how they can become more creative, so that they can sort of problem solve without resorting to, you know, violence and other kinds of things. That's available on the interweb if you want to Google my name and creative thinking and Army. So I do actually in my kind of sideline offer a lot of practical advice when I'm not talking about Hamlet and Jane Austen.
I was going to say, going back to what you're saying about the literary critics, I think it's the fact that, like you said earlier, there hasn't been anything like this that is making the distinction between the science and the literary in the way that you have. Like, I've never heard of anything, I've never read anything similar to this. So I think it's like breaking down that wall. And if they are too far on the literary side and they don't like the scientific aspect, I think they might get their hunch up a bit, which is perhaps the reason why. Whereas that's why the scientists love it, because they're like, yes, we were right.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that's fair. And I think, you know, the book does challenge fundamentally a lot of what we're taught in school by literary critics. And, you know, I think on a certain level, you know, the reason I do that is because it's just not working. It's just not working. I mean, students are not embracing it. You know, it's time, I think, for some new ideas and some fresh ideas. And the reason for that is because literature itself is such a wonderful resource, and being able to talk about it and use it and share it and give that gift to students, especially at a time now when we are suffering from a lack of so many things literature can give us. You know, when we are experiencing so much emotional frailty, this loss of emotional resilience, and a kind of a loss of creativity and imagination, which we can kind of see and kind of track through schools. Literature is just a simple way to give all that back to students. So I do think it's time for a change. I do think that there needs to be a rethinking of the way that literature is taught. That doesn't mean we need to get rid entirely of the way that things are done now, but it does mean that there needs to be a kind of opening up and a kind of expansion of the curriculum.
An accessibility to it as well, and make it not seem so inaccessible to a lot of people. I don't like when people say that, oh, I don't like reading literary books, because it's almost like so far away and you have to study, like you studied Hamlet and Shakespeare in order to understand it. And they just completely put it to the side and they say, look, you know, it's way too academic for me. Like, I think there needs to be a mindset shift to make it more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's brilliant and completely true. I mean, first of all, accessibility is the key to almost everything. I mean, that's what we want as a democratic society, is to allow everyone to participate in all the wonderful things that exist around us and to stop constructing these ridiculous and artificial barriers to entry all over the place. And, you know, I can say this. I mean, I was born in England. I came to America as an immigrant, you know, and I kind of had to survive as an immigrant in America. And I can say that, you know, because I had that kind of immigrant psychology in America, my family, that's one of the reasons I went into science. My family was like, you got to be a doctor to survive in this new land, you know. And I remember when I went into my first literature classes at a graduate level, I was actually, I felt ashamed at my lack of knowledge compared to the other students. I felt stupid. You know, I had not read Hamlet. I had not read any of these kinds of master classics. I was a bit of a Philistine, and it's a hard thing to feel embarrassed and ashamed by your lack of cultural knowledge. And I think too often in this world, culture is held up as a kind of cudgel to hit people and make them feel stupid or lower class or unworthy or unsophisticated. And, you know, there's this kind of boarding school ethos that, oh, you know, I went to this kind of fancy place, or I went to Oxbridge or whatever, you know, and I got to read the classics, you know, and you know, you street urchin, you know nothing. And the reality of almost all the great works of literature that are in this book, you know, whether it's Homer, whether it's Shakespeare, you know, whoever it is, they started out as popular literature. They did not start out as these kinds of elite art forms. You know, I mean, Shakespeare, obviously, famously, I mean, he was competing with like bear baiters and jugglers and whatnot, you know. And Homer was the kind of common poet. I mean, everyone in Athens and across a lot of Greece read or listened to Homer in some kind of oral form. So I think we just need to return to those roots. Most classic literature is just pulp literature that an academic has gotten their hands on and kind of made snobby. But the pulp core is still there, and it still speaks to the heart. And even if Homer is not your jam, because I admit it was written, you know, 2,600 years ago, you know, and, you know, is not as immediately accessible as something that was written in the past decade, a lot of the technologies that are in Homer exist in other more modern books. And I go through, you know, Wonderworks, I go through the book and I explain that. I say, you know, if you like the idea of Homer, but you don't actually like reading Homer, you know, go ahead. Here's how Game of Thrones works. And here's how some of the technologies from Homer can be found in Game of Thrones. And I think that that push to make it more accessible and tear down the sense of elitism is definitely something that would be good for literature and for us all.
Definitely. The accessibility to read the books, but also to become a storyteller as well. I think so. Because I think it's almost a barrier to entry for a lot of people to tell stories, because it's like, well, I don't want to tell my story. Who am I, kind of thing?
I mean, that is just another beautiful insight and completely true. We need more voices. We need more stories. I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the Joseph Campbell problem, is our world is only going to survive if we have different narratives. And those narratives have always come from the margins. They've always come from people who were not necessarily kind of part of the dominant cultural tradition. You know, all the writers in the book, all the great writers in the book, whether it's Homer, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's Maya Angelou, whether it's Jane Austen, you know, take your pick. They did not go to like the best schools, and they were not kind of part of the ruling elites. And we need to, as a democratic society, realize that our strength comes from empowering people who have different perspectives, who come from different backgrounds, to tell their stories, to share their voices, and for us to listen to them and then pull them into our libraries. And so absolutely, I mean, that's not just an act of charity and kindness and justice. That's a practical act which helps us thrive and be more dynamic and more resilient in the future.
Yeah, I think a lot of people want more equality or diversity in the publishing industry, but they're coming at it from a political point of view, which I don't particularly like. It's like, we need to get these people in because we need to be making, you know, we need to be more diverse. We need to show people, you know, and that's good, but it's almost like you're completely negating about the fact that these people actually have a story to tell. It's like that we just want to get them in because it's more diverse and we want to seem like it's, you know, we're pushing and we're being modern, but you're not actually thinking about, oh my God, they have so many great stories to tell.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's this tokenization problem. And it's completely demeaning to anyone who gets sucked up in that apparatus. It's like, oh, we want to publish you because you're a woman. Well, thanks for that, but I'm actually an individual with my own life story and my own voice, and I'm a lot more than just a woman. And by the way, every woman is different from every other woman. So I agree, this whole kind of tokenization kind of pseudo-diversity thing that has infected a kind of certain kind of, you know, politics that we have nowadays is not helpful, because really what we want to be doing is we want to be encouraging different voices to be different and to be themselves and to say we value who you are, not because you help our politics or you make us feel good about ourselves, but because you challenge us. You say something we weren't expecting, you know, you enrich our lives with something that we never could have imagined. And I don't think there's enough in the publishing industry now of taking a risk on works. Everything has to be kind of packaged and smoothed out. And I think a lot of authors, particularly younger authors, get pulled into that and they become self-conscious and they sort of silence themselves or narrow themselves to please what they think their publishers want. And it just produces a lot of generic stuff rather than going in the opposite direction and saying, you know, write what's most different about yourself. Write what's most unique. Challenge the audience, you know? The audience can step up and we'll help you find your audience, you know, and we'll work together. That's really what I do think we need a lot more of, is a lot less the kind of superficial diversity, which helps no one, and a deep commitment to different voices, different narratives, different lives.
The challenging thing is really interesting, because one of my favorite authors is Dostoevsky. And I remember reading the first line, famous first line from Carmen, Notes from the Underground, where he says, like, I'm a sick man, I'm a spiteful man, I'm an unattractive man. I thought to myself, holy crap, where does this come from?
That's exactly right. And I think that book had that same galvanizing effect on the generation and on pretty much every reader who continues to read it now.
Yeah.
And to come out and say that, and that's actually what we want as readers. We want to be challenged. We want to be surprised. We don't want to be affirmed. And, you know, we've just created this very unhealthy media system in which everyone is going around trying to affirm audiences and not rattle audiences and kind of be as vanilla as possible and kind of, you know, have these kind of micro demographics that they're just kind of recycling the same opinions to. And what we want is, we do want to be challenged. We want to grow. We want to be challenged in a helpful way. We don't want to be attacked. We don't want to be told that we're stupid and we're wrong. But we want to be able to make that leap of empathy, of curiosity. I mean, that's why as a child we get up in the morning, because we're excited to see what is going to be new today. What's going to be different in my world that I did not imagine. And it's kind of having that open heart and that desire to see something that is different, that is strange, that is perhaps even unpleasant or ugly. Because, I mean, ugliness is just... really, all we're saying there is it doesn't conform to our current standards of beauty, you know? But to say this thing that fits outside what we expect to be good, but that actually connects with us emotionally, that's the future of literature. That's always been the history of literature, is to challenge us in that way, is to be new, to be innovative. And it's certainly my hope that the publishing industry catches up. And, you know, if not, literature will find a way, because it always has.
That's a brilliant way to end our conversation, Angus. We've touched on many concepts from your book, Wonderworks, Literary Invention and the Science of Stories. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Where's the best place for individuals to find you, whether it be social media or a website?
So I don't do social media because I don't have the bandwidth for it, but you can find me at my website at angusfletcher.co. And a lot of my research, including some of my wackier research on AI and with American Special Forces and whatnot, is all there.
I'll put the link in the description below so everyone can check that out. I know I will be checking that out, especially on those papers. They sound really interesting. Anyway, Angus, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Angus definitely has a wealth of knowledge and a broad range of perspectives on the topic, so it was great to have him on and discuss the subject. If you would like to find out more about his research, I have put the link to his website in the description below, so you can check that out, and also a link to purchase his book as well, Wonderworks, Literary Invention and the Science of Story. It's a pretty hefty one, but as you probably tell from the conversation, he definitely has a lot to say and a lot of research behind the things that he is saying. So thanks again for watching this podcast. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast for more weekly interviews with authors. 2022, I know, is going to be a big year for the podcast. So if you want to keep up to date with all the podcasts that are coming out weekly, please do subscribe on any platform that you listen to this on, whether it's YouTube, Spotify, or Apple. Please do subscribe and leave a rating as well. Thank you so much for checking out this podcast again, and I look forward to seeing you in the next one.